Glass's brother, Mark Vincent, who is presently residing in Boston, Massachusetts, but originally from England, and his class is From Paradise to the Promised Land. So we turn our attention over to Mark Vincent.
Well, good morning, everybody. First of all, apologies for my absence last night. You may have thought that I was putting the principle of this is a vacation, not just a Bible school, into practice. But actually, that wasn't the case. I was putting my children to bed. So just to give you a little orientation about what this class is meant to be about, there's our subject, From Paradise to the Promised Land, which, of course, implies a journey. We're going from one place to another. And the way in which we do that in the scriptures is, of course, in the book that we know, or the set of five books that we know as the Pentateuch. So I could also have called this series the Pentateuch, but I figured not as many of you might have come if we'd done that. But that is, in fact, what it is. I've got you here under false pretenses. We're going to have five classes, one on each of the five books of the Pentateuch. And it's a critical point, then, that what the Pentateuch does is it takes us on this journey from the creation, in the beginning, God created, right to an open doorway at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, when we're about to enter into the land that God has promised us. And of course, that whole historical scene, when God created, when God set up the Garden of Eden, invited man and woman to go into it, to the point where they stand on the brink of going back in a way, to another kind of garden, the Garden of the Promised Land, is a thing that happened in history, but is also a thing that happens for each believer by God's grace. Because we too are on a journey. We have been reborn, and we too are heading to a promised land that awaits us when the Lord Jesus Christ returns. So that whole journey that Israel took of old, as God called them, made them into a special people for his name, and led them towards the promised land, that is a picture, it's a pattern for us and the journey that we're on. So, let's start then, first of all, by thinking a little bit about these five books that make up the Pentateuch. And of course, there are a number of names that the first five books of the Bible have, and the first one is the Pentateuch. Penta, of course, is five. Think of a pentagon having five sides. Teuch means a volume or a book. Scroll, five-volume scroll. Good enough name for it, isn't it? But not a very inviting name. Well, of course, there are other names. The term Torah is the word that the Jews use, and it's pretty much become an English word as well now, hasn't it? Because of the frequency with which it's used. And of course, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, as we have it, as Christians regard it, is regarded by Jews as being made up of three parts. Torah, the first five books, they're the foundation then on which everything else is built, both for Jews and for Christians. So, you know, these really are foundational books. And secondly comes Nevi'im, which is the prophets, and then Ketuvim, the writings. Put the three letters, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, TNK, together, and you get Tanakh, which is the Hebrew term for their Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And the first part of that, then, the first constituent part, is the five books of the Pentateuch, the Torah. What does the term Torah mean? Well, we think of it as meaning law. It does mean law, but it's a wider term than merely a legal code. That's the trouble with the English word law, isn't it? You think of rituals, you think of thou shalt not, you think of rules and regulations, but the Hebrew word is used much more widely than that. And if you just, I can read this to you, or Deuteronomy 1, just one example of a quick verse here in Deuteronomy 1, just to illustrate the wider use of the term. Deuteronomy 1 and verse 5. On this side Jordan, in the land of Moab, began Moses to declare this law, saying, the Lord our God spoke to us in Horeb, saying, ye have dwelt long enough in this mountain. And then Moses goes on into four or five chapters, which are a recitation, not of rules and regulations, but of history, and of teaching about that history. So law, yes, a part of what law is about is rules and regulations, but it's much more widely teaching, God's teaching. So if we think of the first five books of the Old Testament as being the law, there are rules and regulations in there, there is law in there, but there is teaching from God as well. So that's quite important. And then, of course, these five books are also called the books of Moses. Did Moses write it all? Well, there's no particular reason why we should think that he did. The fact that it's referred to as the law of Moses in the New Testament does not itself imply that every single part of it was written by Moses. It's unlikely that Moses wrote the account of his own death, unless he did it prophetically in advance. And similarly, there are other references in the Pentateuch where it talks, for example, about, you know, when you read something like, as it is to this day, that sort of implies that you're standing at a later time looking back, doesn't it? So you remember as well that the book of Numbers refers to the book of Jasher. So we know that in ancient times there were a number of writings from which the five books that we have are the ones of those ancient writings that God, in his wisdom and providence, chose to preserve for us. And really, whether Moses or some other writer took some ancient words, ancient writings for the patriarchal stories of Genesis, for example, and used those, or whether he wrote it himself, dictated directly from God, doesn't really make any difference, does it? As long as we believe that these are the inspired writings of God. This is what God wants us to understand. This is the foundation for the whole Bible. But I think the term, the books of Moses, is a good term for the Pentateuch, even if we don't understand it as literally every single full stop and capital letter was written by Moses himself. It's a good term to use because, of course, these are Mosaic books. Exodus begins with the birth of Moses. Deuteronomy ends with the death of Moses. And the covenant of Sinai, which so much of these books are about, was mediated through Moses. So they are very clearly books of Moses and the law of Moses in that sense. So, there's nothing wrong with the term whatsoever. Let's just take a quick look at how the five books got their name. So in every case, the English words that we use to identify these books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, those actually come from Greek words. They come from the title of these books in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And underneath those, I've put the Hebrew name of each of the books. So let's just work through those in turn. So Genesis comes from the Greek word, which means generations, genealogy, origins. So these are the generations of the heavens and the earth in 2 verse 4. These are the generations of Adam in 5 verse 1. And there are a set of genealogies or generations in the book of Genesis. And it's very interesting then that the Greek Old Testament chose to take that word and use that as the title for the book. And Matthew 1 verse 1 picks up on that, when it says the book of the generations of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, again using the word Genesis there in Matthew 1 verse 1. So that's what the Greeks called it, Genesis, and that's what we call it too. In the Hebrew Bible, it's called in the beginning, which of course is the very first word of Genesis, isn't it? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So they call the book Bereshit, which in Hebrew means in the beginning. Exodus, that again comes from a Greek word, two Greek words, ex, out of, and hodos, way out, exit, the exit from the land of Egypt. We're on our way out of here, out of slavery, out of bondage. And you remember that word Exodus is used in the New Testament as well, when in the Transfiguration, Jesus appears with Moses and Elijah, and they speak of his decease, Exodus, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. The Hebrew name for the book of Exodus again comes from its very first words in the Hebrew. These are the names of the people who came out, who went into Egypt, the 70 sons of and descendants of Jacob. Leviticus, the Greek word Leviticus, originally meant priests, so it was a more specific word than Levites, and the underlying meaning of that word, of course, has to do with being joined, and that we can think of the priest as being the kind of glue, or again the thing that goes in between God and the common people. Hebrew term is "and God called." First words of the book of Leviticus. Numbers, again, comes from the Greek word. There are two censuses in the book of Numbers. That's why it's called the book of Numbers. In Hebrew, it's called "in the wilderness." That's what Numbers 1 verse 1 begins with, "in the wilderness." Deuteronomy, the second law. Now, that comes from Deuteronomy 17 verse 18. It's probably worth us just having a quick look there. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 18. "And it shall be, when the king sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites." So, the king then had to write this copy of the law. He had to write out by hand a copy of the law. And that word "copy" is the word from which Deuteronomy comes. Deuter meaning second, and nomos meaning law, the second law. And we'll think in our fifth class about in what sense Deuteronomy is a second law. Now, what this series is all about is about standing back and taking the big picture. So often in our Bible study, we turn to a passage and we look in some detail at a passage, don't we? We might talk about, you know, this word means this, and we might look at other places where it occurs and so forth. We do Bible study at that quite close, at micro level. But what I think is also a helpful thing to do is to stand right back and say, okay, for the details, but let's just make sure that we're getting the message from the big picture of what God's word is all about. And of course, you know, the rest of the time that we've got today, we're dealing with 50 chapters of the book of Genesis, so we're not going to be able to say very much about the details. We're covering a couple of thousand of years history now in maybe 30 minutes or so that we've got left. So we're not looking at details. We're trying to say, well, let's stand back and see if we look at Genesis as a whole, what is the message that comes across to us? What is the teaching that God's trying to get over to us? And, you know, we can even stand back further than the book of Genesis and say, well, let's look at the Pentateuch as a whole. Let's start in Genesis and end in Deuteronomy and think about what kind of message there would be from that. And it's quite interesting if we... my slides advance. If we set the book out like this, so obviously here I'm suggesting that there's a pattern. So you've got an A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A sort of pattern, which the technical term for which is a chiasm. And you can see the shape of it pretty clearly there. The Greek letter chi has this same shape as that, like our letter X does. You know, it goes in and then it comes back out again. So if you put Genesis and Deuteronomy on the outside of that, and then you put Exodus and Numbers in the next stage in. So they're at the B level. What are the links between Exodus and Numbers? Well, both Exodus and Numbers recall the account of a journey in the wilderness. A journey, in the case of Exodus, from Egypt into the wilderness to Sinai. And in the case of Numbers, a journey from Sinai through the wilderness towards the Promised Land. So they both have this wilderness journey in them. They both deal with Sinai. So that's part C then. We arrive at Sinai, and then in Numbers 10, we leave Sinai again. So the whole of the Pentateuch then has Sinai right in the middle of it. And then if we look in the middle of what happens at Sinai, we find ourselves in the book of Leviticus, which has 44 chapters. You notice that Exodus and Numbers both have a pretty similar, not number of chapters, that's the number of pages in my particular Bible. So they're of a similar length, Exodus and Numbers. Then Leviticus, much shorter book in the middle with 44 pages. And what do we find in the middle of the book of Leviticus? Well, we find the Day of Atonement. That's quite interesting, isn't it? The Day of Atonement was, of course, that one special day where the community at large, where their fellowship with God was renewed, where the scapegoat, as it were, bore all their sins away. And as a people, as a whole, they were reconciled to God. And they had that wonderful visual symbol of their sins fleeing away into the wilderness, never to be seen again. And that then lies right at the heart of the Pentateuch. The very fivefold shape, you know, suggests Leviticus as the middle book. And right in the middle of the book of Leviticus, and we won't go into it now, but there are good reasons for saying that that chapter 16, the Day of Atonement, is the middle of the book. How appropriate that should be right at the heart of the Pentateuch. Well, enough on the Pentateuch as a whole. Let's get into Genesis. And when we get into Genesis, we find that the whole book is arranged around a series of genealogies. And I already quoted one of them to you in 2 verse 4 of Genesis. These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And similarly at 5 verse 1, this is the book of the generations of Adam, in the day that God created man in the likeness of God made he him. And if we should just look through Genesis and pull out now all those records of genealogies, we would find that there are 10 of them. So the whole book of Genesis revolves around these 10 sets of genealogies, and there they are. Those are the references. Now you notice over the right-hand side there, I've put an N or a G, because there are two types of genealogies in Genesis. Some of them are exactly what you would expect. These are the sons. This is the genealogy or the generation of Adam. Adam begat Seth. Seth begat, and you have basically a vertical genealogy. Yeah, he had a son. He had a son. He had a son, and we're stepping down through the generations like that. A vertical genealogy. Those are the ones with the G's after them, genealogies. The ones with N's after them are genealogies of a different type. These are the generations of the heaven and earth. And what we then have is a description of what happened to the heavens and the earth. These are the generations of Noah. And instead of, let's pick an accurate one. These are the generations of Jacob. Look at the last one there. And what we have there is not a list of Jacob's sons. We're not stepping through the ages. What we have is the story of Jacob. This is what happens in Jacob's life. So it's a kind of horizontal genealogy. These are the generations of Jacob. And then we expand out into, and this is the story of Jacob. So the term genealogy there, then, in Genesis, has these two senses. So, what we've done then, by noting these genealogies, is divided the book into 10 parts. I mean, 10's, you know, it's quite interesting that it should be, that the book should be built around these 10 sets of genealogies, because there are a number of these 10 patterns in the scriptures. Genesis chapter 1, the creation of the heavens and the earth, is built on the 10 occasions on which the text says, and God said, let there be light, and God said, let us make man in our image. 10 divine commands to create the world. 10 sets of generations now in the book of Genesis as a whole. If we go into the book of Exodus, of course, we find the 10 commandments. These are the 10 ways in which you, people, me and you, are to live our lives. And there are other ones as well that we'll perhaps take a look at. Now, usually what happens is we have a genealogy, and then we have a piece of narrative, And then we have another genealogy, and then we have another piece of narrative. But sometimes we get two genealogies next door to each other, with no narrative in between. So you could call those double genealogies. And they help us divide the book into four parts. And probably the best way to see that is here. So you have chapters 1 to 11, which have within them single genealogies. And then at the end of chapter 11, you have a double genealogy, which says in it, these are the generations of Shem, these are the generations of Terah. And then you get all the chapters about Abraham, and then you have another double genealogy. These are the generations of Ishmael, these are the generations of Isaac. And then you have the chapters about Joseph. Sorry, about Jacob. And then you have another double genealogy, Esau and Jacob. And then you have the chapters about Joseph. So it's very clear then, isn't it? There's a very clear shaping device here in which the book of Genesis is given a particular shape into these four parts. So you have chapters 1 to 11, which are the international part of the book. Then you have a double genealogy. Then you have the chapters about Abraham, double genealogy. Then the chapters about Jacob. Then the chapters about Joseph. And you ask the question, well, what happened to Isaac? Did he get missed out somewhere here? Well, yeah, he did. It's quite interesting that Isaac isn't really a main character in the book of Genesis. There's only really one chapter about Isaac, and virtually everything about Isaac is either about, you know, is either part of the Abraham narrative or is part of the Jacob narrative, which is to come. And if you actually look through Genesis 26, which is pretty much everything we've got about Isaac. And I've just made a list here of everything that happens to Isaac in Genesis 26. And you can see that absolutely everything that happens in his life happened either to his dad or to one of his or to his sons. So Isaac is there as a kind of... I'm not quite sure what the purpose of this is, if there's a spiritual lesson to this or not. But it's just interesting as a fact that... that Isaac leads a very derivative sort of life. He just echoes what's already happened in Abraham's life, or he prefigures what's going to happen in the life of his own descendants. So you can see there the sense in which Isaac isn't really a central character. Just want to go back there for 1 second and talk for a moment about the flow of time in these chapters. So the first 11 chapters then are international in nature. This is the creation of everything. This is about men and women at large and what they get up to. This is the Table of Nations in Genesis 10. This is the fall, which impacts everybody, doesn't it? This is international. And the fact that the Bible begins here shows, in fact, that God has a purpose with the whole world. Although when we get to chapter 12, we're going to dive into Abraham and the history of the Jews, the very fact that the Bible doesn't begin with Abraham and the Jews, but begins with a wider view than that of every man and woman, tells us that God has this broader purpose, but that he's going to achieve it through the specifics of Abraham and the Jews in due course. Now, those chapters, 1 to 11, account for about 2,000 years. So we're absolutely ripping through time, aren't we, in Genesis 1 to 11. And then, when we come to Abraham in chapter 12, the pace slows right down, and the remaining chapters, 12 to 50, only cover a couple of hundred years. And even to the end of Deuteronomy, the end of the death of Moses, we've only gone about 700 years to then. So the change of pace here is really interesting. God slows the clock down. He slows the narrative pace down when there's something which is important for us to learn from. So God is, you know, is selecting from history those elements from which there's important teaching for us to learn. So we've got a sense now of how Genesis is broadly structured then. We have this international part, chapters 1 to 11, and then we have the patriarchs, Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph in particular, and these 10 genealogies. What actually happens in the course of the book of Genesis? Well, not really going to talk through this, but it's just quite interesting just to stand back and to think about what it is that God does, his goodness in creation, his willingness to forgive, but how essential that it is that he judges and condemns also. You know, he's not prepared to let men and women get away with whatever they want. He steps in and judges and punishes. He provides for his people. He makes promises to his people. And just by going through these narratives in Genesis and just thinking to ourselves, what is it that God does and what does that tell us about what sort of a God he is, there's really quite a lot for us to learn about him. And similarly, when we consider ourselves and say, well, what do men and women look like then? Well, there are two sides to that. The one side of it is pretty bleak because we keep messing up. You know, we start with the fall in the Garden of Eden, and there's just a catalogue of errors, of rebellion, of sin, of answering back to God. And yet, there are also, corresponding with that, or balancing them out, there are some remarkable demonstrations of faith. So we really see the two sides of human nature in terms of the potential that there is within us. The potential for rebellion against God, and we primarily see that in the first 11 chapters, the international part. And then we see the potential also to respond to him in a faithful and obedient way as a model for our own lives. And that comes in largely in chapters 12 onwards, although of course we see it too in Noah. And as we journey through Genesis with the patriarchs, we find that God reveals more of himself. And there is an opening out of his character and of his identity. As we read through the 50 chapters of Genesis, God keeps introducing us to new terms of identification for himself through which we discover more about his nature and character. Again, that's just... What I wanted to do here is to throw out themes and ideas, and of course all of these, you know, I mean, you'd have a whole talk about that. But, you know, these are sort of angles of ideas that you know, can be the basis of a further study and reflection. Well, let's dive in a little more now into chapters 1 to 11, the international part of Genesis. So, of course, God creates a heavens and an earth which are very good. And he creates a man and a woman to live in them, and he prepares a home for them in the Garden of Eden, and he gives them responsibilities, he gives them a commandment, as we well know. And what happens then? Well, then we have the fall. And that really, that fall of Genesis 3 is just... It's just the starting point to a series of falls, which, you know, it's almost like, you know, there's domino chains that you set up, and the first one goes, and then the whole thing just ripples on through. And these are, again, just reading through Genesis 1 to 11 and writing down the incidents that take place. Well, so we've got the fall, and we've got banishment in Genesis 3. And what happens in the next chapter? You know, what's the first glimpse that we get in the scriptures of family life? Well, it's not an encouraging one, is it? Cain rises up against his brother and murders him. And his blood cries out from the ground. So, you know, if you want to talk about dysfunctional families, this is where it starts. It doesn't get much more dysfunctional than that, does it? And that was the first family already. We've only got one chapter into the story, or possibly two, into the story of man and woman upon the earth. And already we have a brother murdering another brother. And what could that be from God other than, you know, you've got to face the facts. This is what is within our nature. This is where human nature goes if it's unchecked. It just gets worse and worse and worse. The violence, the evil, the sin which is in our hearts has this ability, like a cancer, just to recreate and eat away at human beings. And there is this escalation then of violence that we see. So by the end of Genesis 4, you've got Lamech, and I've not written it on the screen there, but you remember Lamech and his evil boast as he assembles his wives and commands them to sit down and listen to his latest song that he's written. And what does it say? Well, let's have a look. 4:23. And Lamech said unto his wives, Adar and Zillah, hear my voice, ye wives of Lamech. Hearken unto my speech, for I have slain a man to my wounding, and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. And you see what's so evil about that, don't you? Because it's like self-sufficiency. God's going to avenge Cain, fine, but I don't need God to stand up for me. I'll stand up for myself. And if, I've slain a man to my wounding. So if someone injures me, then I'll tell you what I'll do to him. I will kill him for injuring me. And there's no sense of proportion there, is there? You know, he's injured me, so I'm going to kill him. You see, I'm going to escalate it. Whatever he does, I'm going to go one step further. I'm going to put an end to this in his thinking. But of course, he doesn't put an end to anything. It only makes things worse. It just creates a bigger and bigger problem. That's what men do. This is what we're good at on our own, without God. You see how powerful these chapters are as an evocation of what human nature is like. We've got to face that right at the beginning of the Bible. Otherwise, we don't appreciate our need for the rest of it. And then the second line of his song, I have slain a man to my wounding and a young man to my hurt. One translator renders that as a boy for bruising me. And even if he's only a boy, and even if he only bruises me, less than an injury this, just a bruise, then I'll kill him too, though he's only a boy. You see the nastiness in his evil boast there at the end of Genesis 4. And then we've got the marriage between the sons of God and the daughters of men in chapter 6. The imaginations of men's hearts being only evil continually later on in Genesis 6, and God's sorrow and regret at how evil, how quickly man has become, thus bringing about the flood, and then the Tower of Babel. And in each of those cases, except the example of Lamech, which I didn't list, but in all the others listed in here, God responds in some way to their sin, so as to show that what they've done is not acceptable and that there is a consequence for it. And often, the punishment or the response from God is correlates with the nature of what it is that they've done. And often, the Bible will use the same word to describe the punishment as was used to describe the crime. So God is not a God who is distant, who does not care, who just sort of lets people get away with whatever they want to. God sees what is taking place, and he responds to it. But another interesting thing within this is that on virtually every occasion where he responds in judgment, he also embeds there a promise of hope for the future. So at the very time in which God is presenting his punishment of the man and the woman and the serpent, embedded within that is an account of salvation, isn't there? Genesis 3, verse 15. Embedded in there. And God made coats of skins and clothed them. Embedded in there in Genesis 3, verse 21 is the promise, the glimmer of a hope one day. And so it is with Cain too, that God places a mark upon Cain so that he should not be slain, even though that's what he deserves in one sense. In the case of the flood too, God starts a new beginning and blesses blesses his creation again. Well, there's one more thing that I wanted to say about Genesis 1 to 11, and that's to do with the flood. The flood, of course, is the longest narrative, isn't it, in Genesis 1 to 11. It's almost, though not quite, the longest narrative in Genesis. Starting at chapter 6 and going through into chapter 8, possibly into chapter 9. So in relation to the size of Genesis 1 to 11 as a whole, the flood is pretty big and pretty central in there. So what is it that God is teaching us with the flood? Well, it's interesting if you read through the flood narrative, just to have a look at the numbers and time periods that are referred to there. And here, again, if you just write down all the time periods that are referred to in the flood, you find that they're arranged in another one of these chiasms, A, B, C, D, E, D, C, B, A patterns. So there are 7 days of waiting for the flood, which correspond to, at the end, 7 days of waiting for the floodwaters to recede. There are another 7 days of waiting for the flood, which correspond again to a different 7 day period of waiting at the end. There are 40 days of the flood, 40 days of the flood rising, and 40 days of the flood going down again. There are 150 days in which the water prevails upon the earth, and they're matched by 150 days in which the water wanes. Isn't that amazing? And you see, the whole thing of the flood is actually, you know, you can imagine the whole thing from this shape as like this huge wave that sweeps over the earth, and then it goes back again, just in the same way that it had come, in exactly the same shape. There's a beautiful symmetry to it, isn't there? In which God just wipes the slate clean and begins again with a new beginning. And what is it then that's often, you know, when you get these chiastic patterns, A, B, C, B, A patterns, the reason for the shape is to highlight what's in the middle. You remember how we said the Day of Atonement is right in the middle of the Pentateuch. What's in the middle of the flood narrative? Well, I think it's what's at 8 verse 1. And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that was with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. And God remembered Noah. It's about a connection, isn't it? We're completely reliant on God, you know, for the waters to go back again and for that new beginning to be ours. It all depends on God and his care. The fact that he cares, the fact that he bothers, the fact that he remembers our needs and our frailty. And our hope is based on the same hope. The God who remembered Noah will be the God who remembers us, because he doesn't change. He's the same God. He's a God who is characterized by remembering, by knowing, by seeing, by hearing what's going on in our lives. And that was the basis for the new beginning that he granted them. And what a new beginning it was, in fact. If we look at the new beginning that God gives to Noah and his family after the waters have gone back again, it corresponds very interestingly with the original beginning in Genesis 1 and 2. So the earth emerges from the water again. Isn't that how God created? That was part of the creation process in Genesis 1, wasn't it? That the waters went back and the dry land appeared. And so it is again now. That God blesses them and says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And God says that once in chapter 1, and he says it again in chapter 8 and chapter 9, and he gives his blessing to the creation in both parts. And he gives instructions about food. And in the beginning, he says in Genesis 2, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the particular tree you shall not eat. And in chapter 9, he gives instructions about foods again, but this time it's about meats and blood that he gives instruction. But again, there is a fall. Just as there was a garden, and just as there was taking of the fruit, and just as there was shame, and they knew that they were naked, and just there was, as there was a curse placed upon them, well, not upon them, but cursed upon the ground, so too in Genesis 9, and Noah began to be a husbandman and planted a vineyard. So he makes his own garden, as it were, doesn't it? And he takes of the fruit thereof, and he drinks the wine, and he becomes drunk, and he becomes uncovered in his tent, and his son sees his nakedness, whatever that means. And the result is, cursed be Canaan, Noah says. And we've just reenacted in slightly different ways, we've reenacted the fall again. So what is this about then? Why is this there as this long narrative in the middle of Genesis 1 to 11? So Genesis 1 to 11 is international then. This is what human beings are like. They fall repeatedly, they fall again, and each time they fall harder. Their violence and their evil escalates upon the earth. What can we do about that? Can they save themselves? No, they can't. No surprises there. The only way that we can get it right with God is for God to make a new beginning. Oh, and he does. There it is in the flood. He makes a new beginning to show us that this is the way that it will be done. It will be done through this new beginning pattern, this pattern of the flood. And you know, we think about that as baptism and the recreation when Jesus comes back and so forth. Now, the new beginning in Noah's day wasn't the beginning. There was another fall again immediately afterwards by Noah. We just talked through that. But it was a type of a new beginning that is ours through the work of the Lord Jesus. Well, we need very quickly now to take a quick look at chapters 12 to 50. So we've done all that international stuff and we found that it doesn't work. We found that men and women will not live up to their responsibilities towards God. They will not behave themselves. Their sin just grows and worsens. And they are astray from God. And so what does God do? God reaches in now, as it were, into history and picks out one man. He picks out Abraham and he calls Abraham to serve him. And this is now the way in which God's purposes will be taken forward, by the selection of an individual faithful man who, by showing obedience and faith towards God, can have that faith counted to him as righteousness. And because of his faith, God makes that man promises. And those promises now that begin in Genesis 12, the start of the Abraham narrative, as we now move into this whole new section of Genesis, which starts the whole of the Old Testament history with the Jews, Abraham, the father of the faithful, there is now this rhythm to the narrative. And what is that rhythm? It's the rhythm of the promises, isn't it? We can't get away from the promises in the rest of the book of Genesis, particularly in the life of Abraham. In virtually every speech that God makes in the book of Genesis, from chapter 12 onwards, he makes a promise. He can't help himself. That's the sort of God that he is. He's a God that wants to make promises to people. He wants to give them things of his goodness and graciousness and bounty, because that's who he is. He is the God who gives, the God who makes promises, and those are the promises there, some of them. And the promises keep expanding and growing in their scope, and then they're repeated again to Isaac and to Jacob. And the rest of the Pentateuch and the rest of the Old Testament can be thought of as those promises moving towards their fulfillment. The rest of the Bible is the history and development of those promises, isn't it? They're fundamental, and when people, as they have in the past, have spoken of Genesis as the seedbed of the Bible, it's absolutely right in this sense, this concept of promise and the development of promise, the concept of covenant, a covenant between God and man, and the history of that covenant is what the Bible is all about. That's why the Pentateuch is the foundation of the Bible. Let's have a quick look at a couple of other patterns that we find in the lives of the patriarchs. Here are some of the things that happen to them. They leave their homes. It happens to Abraham. It may happen to Isaac, depending on how you interpret a particular passage. It happens to Jacob and it happens to Joseph. They have barren wives. They have that, you know, that she is my sister incident. Abraham has that twice. Isaac has that once. Sibling rivalry. Not quite sibling in the case of Abraham and Lot. That's why I've put a question mark there. But you can see, again, there was a family tension, wasn't there, with Abraham and Lot, which Abraham, of course, deals with very wisely. And there were certainly family tensions with Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. You remember the Ishmael-Isaac rivalry and the mocking that took place. And dreams and promises also. So it's quite noticeable, isn't it, once you tabulate it like that, that there are these motifs that recur. So one of the things for us to do in our Bible studies then and thoughts are to think about why that would be, about why there would be these repetitions and what the significance of them would be. Because a number of them relate to the question of faith, don't they? And this must be one of the dominant themes in Genesis 12 to 50. So God makes a promise, but it appears as though history is not configuring itself in favor of that promise being fulfilled. So God promises a great multitude of descendants, and yet the patriarchs can't even seem to have one child, let alone a great nation, in time after time. How much do you believe in God? Then it looks as though the seed is in danger. When the seed finally arrives, in the case of Isaac, is he going to survive? Is Jacob going to survive the violence of his brother Esau? Is there enough faith for them to leave their home and go where God wants them to go? Can they continue to trust in him in the challenges and difficulties of their lives? These are the issues that Genesis raises. And these are the issues of our own discipleship, aren't they? Can we believe that God is in control and that he will move towards the fulfillment of his promises? Because at times we doubt it. And that's why these narratives are here, to strengthen us. I want to just talk. I mean, that kind of speaks for itself, I think. So I don't really need to talk through that slide. But just want to mention the trials of Abraham for a minute, and the demonstration of Abraham's faith as a kind of concluding point. Of course, we start lots of our lots of our preaching begins with the promises to Abraham. So we're familiar with the first few verses of Genesis 12, aren't we? And what is Abraham asked to leave behind there? He's asked to leave his country, his kindred, his father's house, and go to a land that God would show him. That's what he'd asked to do. A land which he'd never seen. He had no idea what it would be like. But he had to trust God that it would be worth it. And that it would be worth giving up everything that he knew and that was familiar to him. Now that is a big ask, isn't it? It's a big ask. And but in a way, it's a big ask to believe that Jesus will come back. And yet we believe it. So, you know, there are analogies here. You know, because people out there will think we're crazy for believing that. And of course, there's a basis for our belief. So Abraham is asked to leave behind his past, essentially, isn't it? Your past is, you know, it's everything that you've known. It's all the places that you're familiar with. It's the chair that you like to sit in. It's your habit. It's the people that you know, that you feel comfortable with. And Abraham has to leave all that behind. He has to leave his past to press forward towards the prize of he doesn't know quite what, but God tells him it'll be good, so he trusts in that. And we might think about ourselves heading towards the kingdom in a similar kind of way. So that's Abraham's first test then, to surrender his past and to reach out for God. And what is his last major test, as the book of Genesis puts it? Well, it's in Genesis 22, when God says, take now thy son, thine only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah. And God doesn't make it easy, does he? Take now thy son. Well, maybe there's a couple of people that Abraham could think of there. Your only. Isaac, the one who you love. God lays it on thick, doesn't he? And what the challenge is here to Abraham's faith. And, you know, I wonder if this is about Abraham's future, isn't it? Aren't Abraham's hopes for the future sort of crystallized in Isaac? That Isaac represents his future. God has promised that he will be a great nation, and that it will be through Isaac. And now God says, well, take Isaac and offer him up. And it's a challenge for Abraham to trust that even though God is asking him to give that which is most precious to him, is Abraham prepared to surrender what he thought was his future in order to be with God now in this instant and to show faith to God today in this crisis? Does Abraham have that kind of faith? Well, yes, he does. And it's that kind of faith that's counted to him for righteousness. And it's that kind of faith that makes him the father of the faithful. And that makes that whole journey from paradise towards the promised land possible.